Hello, and welcome to the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast. This is John Goodwin, your host. This podcast is dedicated to the aspiring writer and artist, and will provide inspiration and tips from top professionals in the field. If you've been listening to this podcast or are new to it, I thank you very much. I would also appreciate if you took a moment to follow it on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts. Writers of the Future is one of the longest-running writing competitions in the world, now celebrating four decades of providing a helping hand as initially conceived by Owen Hubbard. I also want to let you know that the Writers of the Future volumes are available in bookstores throughout the U.S., Canada, the U.K., South Africa, and Australia, as well as to all major online retailers. Today's guest is the Writers of the Future coordinating judge, Jody Lynn Nye. She is the next of several interviews I'm doing specifically related to the 40th anniversary of the contest. Welcome, Jody.
Thank you. Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Yeah. So on the subject of, I guess, Writers of the Future, for those people that don't know you, please give a little bit about your history as a writer and how you, worked up the ranks to becoming such a prolific author and then eventually becoming the judge, which we'll discuss in further questions here.
Well, I've been writing all my life. I've been telling stories to my brothers and my cousins and the campers who were in my cabin at sleepaway camp. Anywhere I possibly could, I would be writing down stories on notebooks and throwing them in the backseat of my car. My best friend always said she could reach in the back of my car and find something interesting to read. So it's been a long time coming. I started writing professionally with technical articles for a magazine called Video Action, but at the same time, I was also writing my own fiction. I first had the chance to publish professional fiction. First short story was in a set of anthologies called The Fleet, edited by David Drake and Bill Fawcett, and it just went on from that. I've reached now right around 200 short stories published and around 56 books of various kinds, most of it science fiction and fantasy, most of it with a humorous bent. So
absolutely,
I have
the queen
had
of humor.
Really amazing breaks.
Yes, that's great. Thank you. So now, how long have you been the contest coordinating judge?
Since January of 2022, I received a call from you about the passing of David Farland, David Wolverton. I've known him for many years before that, and it was a terrible shock.
Yes,
that he had passed.
It was definitely unexpected. I've just been talking to him a few days before about. He said, "I'll need to pass on doing because we do these quarterly." Live Q&As. I'll have to pass this time. Let's schedule me for the next one. It was really unfortunate. It was a real surprise. But we're so happy that we had you there that we could, reach out to. So you were selected because of your obvious love for genres of science fiction and fantasy, your ability and success as a teacher, because you've been teaching that at least the one I know of, the class or the course at Dragon Con, and we'll talk about other ones that you're going to enlighten me on, and a similarity in taste and storytelling to what was initially set by Mr. Hubbard and carried on by Algis Budrys and Katie Wentworth and then Dave Wolverton. So I'd like to discuss with you, why it's so important to have, that type of storytelling, and what was originally created and how that is able to continue on. Why is that so important?
I think science fiction is incredibly important because to me, it's always been the literature of hope. It suggests that we have a future, that we're going to go out into space, we're going to learn more about science, we're going to meet other creatures who do not look like us, and we're not going to kill them, and we hope they're not going to kill us. But we keep looking up, we keep looking out into the future, and I think it's incredibly positive. So for me, science fiction always has its eye on the next milestone, the next advance. And science can't lie. People can lie. But if you perform an experiment and you perform it exactly the same way the next time, it should have the same outcome if there are no other variables. So I find that to be a positive thing as well. It's like a mathematical equation. People respond to that because they like a story to have a purpose. Science fiction is tricky. Fantasy is the same way because you need to tell a good story, but you also have to have good world building. You have to have good science fiction or fantasy element in it. And it just has to be a quality story all the way around. We're very picky in science fiction and fantasy what we accept as mm-hmm. being in the genre. It can't just have the trappings pasted on it. It has to do something with the science fiction or fantasy idea. That's very exciting to readers.
Yeah, I mean, it is. And I'm always amazed at, you think, okay, there's certain kinds of story ideas, but each year when the books come out, it's like, how'd they think that? You know, it's such a new take, you know, on an existing trope, but yet it is just so refreshingly creative what our winners have done, what you're able to discover that have been being submitted from all over the world, which is amazing.
Oh, yes. I'm always delighted when I can see an absolute winner, something that just grabs my imagination and I can't stop reading it. And yeah. when I come to a point where I say, oh, I did not see that coming and I love it, that makes my day.
Yeah.
And I know that it will make the readers of the anthologies, they will love it too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, they do. It just, the amount of reviews that come in, that just, it always has such a high star rating every year. And just the reviews itself that come in from all the trade publications are always just like, they're so gracious with their amazingly kind comments, you know, but it's earned, you know, and every year the book earns either an International Book Award or one of those, you know, book awards because of the quality of storytelling that it is. Now, the world is more and more divisive, it seems. And so without going political, I'm not saying that. I'm a registered independent. So I keep it straight down the middle when it comes to Writers of the Future. So what's the value of science fiction and fantasy to help diffuse this scene that we've got there? And how do you see Writers of the Future as a tool to accomplish that?
One of the wonderful things science fiction can do is, because every story is always about people, no matter what they look mm-hmm. like, no matter what shape they take, but they're still about people. But setting them in a milieu that is not your here and now frequently makes people more accepting of a possibly even a very hard topic. The classic Star Trek series was very good at that, because they were able to do sociological science fiction by mm-hmm. framing it in a way that was science fictional. Then you can say, but it wasn't about that. It was about these two people having this disagreement, or about this scientific advance. And yet people get to talking about it and they accept something that they would not accept if you put it in front of them in a real life situation. And it allows us to have a discussion. Mm-hmm. So for people who are open-minded enough, and most people are to a certain extent, everybody has hardline issues that they will not touch, that they will not change their minds over. But almost everything else you can say, have you ever thought about this in this way? And by framing it as stone people on a heavy world where gravity is five times the strength that is here on Earth, or in a fantasy milieu, you're going to be able to tell them a story and help them accept something new.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I've seen over the years another thing with Writers of the Future, because it has that. It takes these issues, which are very much, I mean, you're an author, you're in there, you're contributing something, and you're writing something that's personal, even however you might coach it, or couch it rather. But it's, you see these things that are difficult to talk about. And when it's on the news, it's incredibly divisive. But in the science fiction scope, it's a little bit more like, you can, and it affords you the ability to actually take a look at another's perspective, another's viewpoint, without immediately going into your defensive mode. And exactly. And, you know, I'm just, or the famous thing where you cover your ears and go, I'm not listening. You know, you agree.
La, 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 la. I can't hear
exactly.
You.
Exactly. You know, and so it puts you, if it's a real well-written story, you're willing to suspend your disbelief enough to be able to ingest whatever it is this author has given, if it's well written enough. And that's one of the things that you're charged with as the editor and as the coordinating judge, to be able to find those stories. And there's no scarcity of stuff coming at you, because it's, I mean, compared to what it was before, you know, when it first started, I mean, yours is a seriously challenging job to go through and select those top stories. But it's also why so many of the winners now can take the fact that they got an honorable mention and put that in their CV and say, look, this is what I've done. I've won. That's not a reject of an honorable mention. I won honorable mention is how the press releases now read. You know, so it's amazing what it's actually done. So what's that like for you? Like, it's got to be like, I mean, I've had discussions with Dave before, but not with yourself, to be able to have to really break down and just see, distinguish between finalists, semifinalists, and on down from there.
It is tough. There are times when I look at something and say, this is almost, and you know, I want to body English it into being good enough to pass because the concept is so good, or the storytelling is good, but the plot is ordinary. And that cannot make it to the top because we've had better. We have had so much better. We've had mind-blowing stories. The semifinalist is probably the most difficult category because it's a story that is as good as a finalist, but for whatever reason, we cannot publish it, or there just isn't room for it in the finalists. But the ones that we can't publish, there have been a couple, one of which I just absolutely fell in love with that I read. It was one of the best written stories I've ever seen, but it had no science fiction or fantasy element in it. So I had to look at it and say, if I can't accept this story, then there are others that don't quite get as far as that in terms of quality. If I can't have that story, then I'm not taking these. They're not going to be able to get an award. I also had one that was profoundly violent, and it doesn't suit our market at all, which meant it couldn't be in it. But instead of being rejected, it was so well written, but the violence could not be removed from the story and still have it intact. So that received a semifinalist position. For finalists, it's almost more obvious because you have something that can't let me go, that I'm so interested in, I'm invested in it, I want to know what happens to the characters, I care about the characters, I can picture them being real people, whatever they look like, as I said. Right. And the plot delights me. Even if it's not something that I personally love, I'm not a huge horror fan, for example, and we do accept light horror or dark fantasy. Not splatter gore or any of the other terrible things that are perfectly acceptable to things like, say, Cemetery Dance. And I have to be so invested in that story to say, I want to show this to Larry Niven. I want to show this to Kevin Anderson. I want to show this to Nnedi Okorafor and have them look it over and say, I think this is good enough to be in the book.
Which is, I mean, it's good. And I know, I'm very happy that we're having this chat because I get asked so much, what do you need from me? What do I have to do? And we say, well, just listen to the podcast, you know, and a couple of people asked, just listen to my interview with Jody. And so they went back. This was at LTUE that just happened a few weeks ago. And I said, I went back and listened. That was so good. Thank you so much for, you know, because it clarified what they need to do. Because some people will only write to this market until they win, and then they'll start writing to other markets. You know, they're just like, they're so dedicated to Writers of the Future. It's great. I mean, it's got such a good reputation, and that an honorable mention will take you out of a slush pile is pretty cool, you know? So the thing that also I think is important, and I mentioned in the email sent before we started up here, where in the very first volume, Owen Hubbard wrote in his essay that launched this contest, a culture is as rich and as capable of surviving as it has imaginative artists. It is with this in mind that I initiated a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for their creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. And it's been 40 years now going on, and that first contest was, I guess, US and Canada, and now we're, you know, overall over 150 countries now that we have entries from. Actually, it's 172. So that datum? How have you seen that borne out to be a true, like the culture is as rich and as capable of surviving as it has imaginative artists? At this time, he's specifically working to, and when he first wrote it, it was just talking about authors as artists, but then it expanded a few years later to the illustrators as well.
I think that what he was hooking into is what Maslow's hierarchy, the hierarchy of needs, speaks to. Because when a culture has physical needs met, then it can move on to emotional needs being met. Then it can go on to intellectual needs being met when the other two are being supported. But the last one is spiritual needs. And I think that art speaks to spirit. And without that, cultures don't prosper. You can see the ones that have faded away where there are ones where there are physical reasons why a culture fell, that they ran out of water or an earthquake took the main city down or whatever happened to them. But they prosper where all the other needs are met, and then they can start to become creative. And I think that it's incredibly important that people feel that they can add to that culture, that we can listen to a lot of different voices. We can see a lot of different forms of art being brought forward and hearing stories from a lot of different voices. And the contest is open to people who have different voices. I would love to see more. We have a couple of stories coming up for volume 40, which we're going to talk about, that are from different points of view, different cultures. And in fact, an author from a country that I think has never had a winner before, Malaysia, in the writers group. So it's a fantastic.
Yeah, she was in Kuala Lumpur.
Lumpur, yes.
Yeah. And we just had her on a radio show yesterday. She's awesome. She's such a cool person.
I can't wait to meet her. She is amazing.
Yeah.
Such an amazingly good writer. I really love that story. And I can't help but think that where you start to cut away at arts being presented to students, where public works of art no longer are created, it means that there is a failure in one of those other levels that Maslow put forward. Sometimes it's physical. Sometimes the culture is too poor to support anything but just basic needs. But where they deliberately say, no art should be able to be put forward because it might give people ideas, then I think that's very destructive. But where art prospers, I think you have a very healthy culture. So I think that Hubbard definitely picked up on that.
Right. In his book, Battlefield Earth, he defines science fiction and fantasy. And in science fiction, he said it's the herald of possibility. And so you're talking about that, the inspiration which can come from a good science fiction, from aesthetics, from art. But when you've got science fiction and fantasy specifically, it's that wonderment, like, I wonder if I can do that, that inspires the rocket scientist or the engineer. And we've had so many engineers, roboticists, astronauts as our keynote speakers who were inspired from reading science fiction. You know, that's what got, oh, I want to do that. And I wonder if I could build something that lands on Mars or on the moon. And that's where they got their, you know, inspiration from reading, you know, going all the way back to, you know, Doc Smith, which is, he's one that got me started on science fiction.
I've talked to a number of scientists who work for NASA, in particular, Les Johnson and Travis Taylor, Dr. Les Johnson and Dr. Travis Taylor, multiply degreed, both of them, who are also writers. And they say that a scientist will bring forward an invention. Science fiction readers will read about it and say, huh, let's extrapolate on that. And then the scientists will come back and say, I wonder if we can do that. So they build upon one each other. They stand on each other's shoulders, and they can reach the stars all the better that way.
Yeah, it's so true. And you weren't with us yet when this happened, but when we had our awards event at Cape Kennedy or Cape Canaveral.
Yeah, I'm jealous.
Yes, that was fun, amazing. Jack Williamson had been writing about going into space since the early 20s. And this was in the, I guess, the mid-late 90s. And so we went there, and we were the closest civilians to the launch. We were about a mile away. We were in the swamps, and you had the signs posted, stay clear from the edges, because there's alligators and snakes and stuff. So, and everybody had to totally douse with mosquito spray, because it was just totally mosquito infested. But we had bleachers there, and all the judges were there, and winners there. And Jack Williamson, even though he was pushing 90 at that point, was just like a little kid. He'd never seen an actual real live space launch, you know. And so seeing that happen, and all the judges too, but for him, because he had been writing about it for 70 years, had never seen it happen in real life. And it was just amazing to see. But it was people like Jack Williamson that inspired the scientists that created, you know, these programs, and then have it now go full circle, you know, and for Jack to be able to have that experience of what he helped to inspire was just, it was just so much fun. It was so amazing. That's one of the best memories I've got of over the years I've been involved with the contest. It was so cool. So based on that.
That is such a delight. He was a really wonderful man and a wonderful writer.
Yeah, he really was. And we've had so many amazing judges over the years. You know, some no longer with us, but the ones that are with us now just continue that tradition. So, from your perspective, what have been some of the best highlights of the Riders of the Future for you over the years that you've been either associated with it or experienced it?
Oh, there have been so many. It's been a huge amount of fun. We've had keynote speakers that have just tickled me, like the fellow who used to be in charge of the Space Force, who turned out to be a really wonderful person to talk to.
General Thompson, yes.
And getting to talk to my fellow pros in the sort of green room where we had a chance to chat with each other. A thing that I did not anticipate when I agreed to become a judge was how many of my friends were already judges. So it was like walking into the green room at a convention and say, oh yeah, there's Rob and there's Kevin and there's Rebecca. And oh yeah, there really wasn't anyone I didn't know. There were a couple I didn't know well. Mm-hmm. So that was delightful. And having it be an incubator for these young writers, because they are thrilled to be there. They are really, really thrilled to be there. And watching their eyes light up. I teach a class at Dragon Con, as you've mentioned, the 2 days writer's workshop. I think I'm going into year 14 now. Wow. And they're enthusiastic about their art, but they haven't won anything yet, and most of them haven't published anything yet. These kids are about to see their short story not only published in a really beautiful volume, but with an illustration. And for me, one of the fabulous things about the contest is the great reveal.
Yes.
Where all of the art is set out in a room with the artists and all of the judges who can fit in there, because we want to see their faces, watching the writers walk in and identifying the piece of art that goes with their story. And it never takes them more than a megasecond to recognize their piece. They may not find it right away. There was once when it was in the little theater at the base of the Roosevelt Hotel, and it was tough to get around in that room. It was very tight. But the moment they see it, they know it. Mm-hmm. And for them, that's a huge privilege, because not only do most writers who publish in science fiction magazines don't get an illustration, they don't get a color illustration. And they get a huge boost. Mm-hmm. It ought to buoy their spirits, as well as giving them a leg up in their field. Mm-hmm. But to have somebody recognize the vision in their story and to create a piece of art about it is thrilling.
Yeah, it's one of the most emotional events too, because the artist is so worried that the author is going to go, oh no, they didn't get it at all. And the author is so worried that they were just like doing their nut trying to find something they could possibly illustrate. And they're both totally, you know, worried about their own perception on the opposite part. Then when they get together, and just that relief just immediately just like blows off, and just, you know, instant hugs, crying. It's really super, super touching, you know. And that's become one of the most talked about parts of the workshop. That and the 24-hour story still gets a big share of discussion, because most of them have never done that before.
But now they prove that they can do it. And I am told that most of them have gone on to publish their stories,
right?
Because something about the pressure and focus brings out incredible creativity. There was one that had an ending that a lot of us said, you know, it could have been better if, and the writer had in fact changed it, because the writer had too much time to think about it and second guessed themselves. So for publication, they went back and fixed it. So it became the story that it always ought to have been. But it's wonderful how much they can call upon that well of creativity, how, because they are all in it together. Mm-hmm. Nobody feels left out. Nobody feels particularly pointed at or pressured. They all have to do it. And they can. And they do.
Yeah. One of your long-term writing partners, Anne McCaffrey, was a judge. She became a judge in year two. As Greg Benford was a founding judge, he was there in the first year, said that getting her on board prevented from being just a bunch of stodgy old white men, you know, as the judges. And she was just...
Anne would never put up with anything like that.
Not at all. And she was a wonderful person to, you know, have on board, as have you been. And, you know, that's one thing that's been good too. We've been trying to open up the contest to be able to address and acknowledge, while keeping in mind the original intent of the competition, you know, and that same type of storyline. And it's about science fiction fantasy. It's about story. It's not about an agenda. There's no agendas, never make it in the book. And it's, which is something I find, because I read a lot of books for this podcast, and people send me stuff. Can I be in your podcast? And sometimes the agenda is speaks louder than the story, you know, and I'm not interested in that. And the contest isn't interested in that. So can you speak that a little bit more about
when a story starts to preach to me, I put it aside, because that's not entertaining to me. We are here to entertain as well, as possibly to teach, possibly to inform, but certainly to entertain.
Yeah. I think it's something that people need to really understand in this. And so can you go over a little bit more, like things that you found that was a good story that you couldn't pass on because it was, or unless you don't want to get into too many specifics on it, but just so people really understand that, because we really do want just really good storytelling and be willing. I guess my ability to suspend disbelief gets severely challenged when I get it, when all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I see what's happening here. And that point, I'm no longer in that story. I'm into, they're trying to sell me their whatever it is.
Yeah, I don't want to buy aluminum siding. Thank you very much. So I just had to reject one that looked promising, even though I did not see how the character was going to be able to accomplish the stated goal of the story. Mm-hmm. And when I sort of skimmed to the middle to see how it was going in the center of it, I thought the writing style was good. It suddenly became a diatribe about modern politics. Whoops. Nope. That is polarizing. Mm-hmm. And also it stopped me dead. There are occasionally times when I'm going to come to something and it's unrealistic and vituperative. And that does not belong in the kind of story we're hoping for.
Right.
We want, if you're going to put something to me that you want to change my mind about something, at least try not to hit me with a 2x4. Try and do it in a surgical fashion. Make me accept it in a different way. But this was a 2x4.
Yeah.
So I really could not accept it. And by the time my slushers get finished with the pile, I have very few that I openly reject. That one was a reject.
Right.
I felt bad about that because there was good writing there.
Mm-hmm.
I also have a sorrow for the stories that either take way, way, way too long to get going, because if it's a wonderful story, I'll never know. because I'm saying, okay, these people are riding in the car and they're talking to each other. How is this science fiction or fantasy? Or where they can't end it. Several quarters ago, I got a really brilliant fantasy that was set in a medieval period, and the person totally lost the plot and went off in a different direction and never ended the plot that they started.
Oh, they didn't deliver what they promised.
I felt terrible about that because it was good writing. I got it back later. It had been rewritten, and it actually ended. It was good. So that made me happy. I was able to give them a good ranking. So I want them to succeed. I want the writers to send me their best stories. Mm-hmm. But if you keep sending me the same story over and over again, I can't perceive any difference in what you're sending me, and it keeps getting the same ranking. Send it somewhere else. Give me something new.
Good. Yeah, that's one thing that some people get. It's not supposed to be a lazy contest. You don't like write your story, keep on sending it, tweak, sending it, tweak, sending it, tweak. No, you've already said at the outset how many stories you've published, how many books you've published. A writer writes, you know, and the only way you can get better is by writing. And there's, if you only have one good idea, then you need to dispel that false idea because it's not true. You got many ideas that can bubble up if you give it an opportunity. And by exercising your writing muscle, you can actually accomplish that.
We're trying to launch careers here as well. It's not the stated goal of the contest. We're here to recognize that excellent story that they have sent us. Mm-hmm. But we're hoping that people will have more than one story in them. True that there are famous writers out there who had the one story that was the blockbuster that made their career, and that was all they had. And that's fine. But we hope that we can find people that we can say later on, yeah, this person had just had a movie made out of this, or this person has a long series of books, or this person has won multiple awards for their skill in telling a story that mm-hmm. really speaks to people.
Yeah. And it's, I think it's something that, another thing too with Writers of the Future that we find, because you have so many new with, they're good, they're excellent writers, but they're not committed to a certain type of story. So they're fresh, they're vibrant. And I find so often that when we have stories published in a Writers of the Future volume, half a dozen years later, that will be what those writers have written. Now that they've actually moved on up the ranking there, that's what you start finding in the bookstores and online. I remember steampunk, we used to see that half a dozen years before it became a thing as a genre. You know, it was just something that was, you'd find things before the uploading and in the mind, the AI, all these things have been, this is like 20 years ago, I was reading this stuff, and then it gradually percolates up now into some of the more mainstream subgenres. And that's one thing that I really find too, there's got to be an amazing joy on your part to see these, open up these gems. You know, you got these geodes and you crack it open, all of a sudden there's this beautiful crystal, this amazing diamond, you know, like, okay, you're brushing it off and it's got to be a wonderful feeling.
It is. It really is. I always want to see something new. I want to see a new idea. Some things have been done to death. If you do it so extremely well that I can pass over the fact that I've seen this plot a million times, yes, I will put it forward. I really will. If it's just another thing on the old trope, I used to play Dungeons and Dragons. Well, actually, I still do. We played yesterday. But we have people that we call old campaigners. And their stories, when they are sent in, I had a friend who used to work for Dungeon Magazine. If you can hear the dice rolling, I'm going to turn it away. And if all I can tell is that you will never put your character into so much danger that he or she or they are in danger of death, then I don't want it. It's just your campaign. You know, here's your dice. Let's roll. No, it has to stand as a story. It cannot say, well, if you look on page 133 of the Monster Manual, you'll see the creature that I'm up against. No, 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 no. Everything inside the bounds of the story has to be enough. And sometimes they make references to things that are not going to be internationally or widely known. Mm-hmm. You have to give enough context so that it's understood by anybody. It adds an extra dimension for the people who are familiar with the source material. But if it can't stand on its own, then again, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's good because some people love science fiction and aren't so much gamers, but this has got, and it's also our stories here are appropriate from middle school on up too. And that's something that people need to reckon with. You know, it's, I just had a thing. I was just meeting with LA City Council, and they have a youth program. And so I gave some of the books to them that they use. And I said, you know, I've had a lot of great responses from Boys and Girls Clubs across the United States about our books, about Rise of Future, as well as about the over 100 Pulp Fiction stories. And it's important because that's, you know, we do really well with military and the parents and grandparents, but it's got to be good also for the middle school.
That is something that I'm always aware of, is how much adult material, and I don't mean sex, I don't mean drugs, but of course that is not in our stories, is acceptable to the story. How much of it fits there without being obvious? Mm-hmm. And is it a good story that depends on character? Is it depending on the plot, or is it going for sensationalism instead of telling a story that is acceptable, that is understandable by young adults?
Mm-hmm. Which is, that's like a key thing. And so people listening to this is one of those, gets a star next to it. This is important that you're writing. This is the market you're writing for. You know, it's not that it's not a good story. It's just, it's not this market. And you have to really understand the market you're writing for, which means you've got to read the rules in the back of the book or the rules on the website on either the contest. What are the rules? We follow the rules. We don't play around with them. The other thing too is, which we talked about earlier, is the use of AI on storytelling. This contest is for creatives. A computer is not a creative. So it's we want people to write the story, and we're pretty good at sussing out when it's an AI story, and it won't get past the gatekeepers. It's just, that's not what this contest is.
You're only cheating yourself by using AI. You're not a creative person, then you're a mechanic. And that's sad. And we will figure it out.
Yeah.
No matter how well you build your new mousetrap, we're going to build a smarter mouse and we're going to figure you out. But I don't want you to cheat yourself. This is an opportunity to show your creativity. If all you are is a glorified computer programmer, go and program computers.
Yeah.
But leave the writing contest to the writers.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And that's the simplicity of it. I've talked to, you know, various people about the AI, and some people are like, oh, they're extolling the virtues of AI. And it's just like, it has its value. It has its, you know, what it can do. But for creativity, this contest is to validate creativity. And the most that the computer will ever be able to do is to take other people's creativity and repurpose it. It itself cannot create.
Yes. You know? It's also ripping off every creative person whom the ChatGPT people have kidnapped and decided to scrape so that they can use it for their own purposes. So it's copyright violation on top of everything else. So you're a plagiarist to start with the moment that you use ChatGPT instead of writing your own story.
Yeah. Good. I think we've stated our position pretty clearly. If someone has a question after this, then English isn't their language or something. They've got other issues, because we're about creativity. And I'll talk to Echo about where we stand right now. But it's a similar perspective on the art as well. So,
well, we've seen AI created art, and that's where you get people with five hands or three eyes or something weird.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's really obvious.
Yeah. We had one person that was a winner that made it through, and then when he was doing the final illustration for the story he was assigned, Echo kept on saying, "Are you sure this isn't AI? Are you sure?" And then finally said, "Yeah, it's AI." And I mean, the guy had been lying all along. Yeah, it was like so not cool. And so we asked for somebody. Well, I gave my money to my church. So, you know, he's just.
Yes, and.
Exactly. And they don't give it back. I'm sure he gave it to his church since he was so honest every other step of the way with us. But, you know, you'd be found out about. And but that's not the purpose of the contest. But as soon as we say no AI, you're going to have certain minded people that immediately take that as a challenge to see if they can game it, see if they can beat it. I'm going to beat the system. So again, their purpose isn't to become a writer. Their purpose is to say, okay, I can show you. And again, that's just, you're doing yourself a disservice, but you're also doing a disservice to other people that really are trying to make a go of it. And that's what we're really trying to do. We're almost 1,000 winners now after 40 years. You know, it's quite a history of providing that future for those that want to make a go of it, as originally created there by Mr. Hubbard there in 83. And anyway, so one thing I was going to ask you about, which is, you know, so with all kinds of stories, when I proofread the book, there's 8 stories written in first person. I was like, wow, because we used to give advice, don't use first person. Now, because first person is very much more intimate, more personal as a story. Is that a trend going, or is this something that these were just, I mean, they're awesome stories. It's an amazing book. And I've had judges tell me this is the hardest time I've ever had working out the grand prize winner for the contest this year, you know, because they're all so good. So anything that's happening right now that, what happened on there?
I give the finalists, I give 8 finalists to the judges every quarter.
Yep.
And I always deliberately make a mix of third person and first person, science fiction and fantasy. I balance it as best I can with the best of the best. And yet this is the ones that they voted for. They voted for first person stories. That's just how it worked out. There will probably come a year where there are no first person stories at all. But this is the one, these are the ones they liked.
Good. I was just curious.
And they're just, they're tremendous.
Oh, they're awesome
stories.
They're
really, really good stories.
Yeah. It's just because I'm totally sold on the fact that what you see in Writers of the Future also heralds the future of science fiction itself, based on the number of reviews that I get from reputable trade publications saying, look at, you know, this is the future of what you're going to be reading on the road. So welcome to your next new favorite authors, you know, and that they're doing that. I'm just wondering if that's also a sign of the times, just because things are so divisive right now, and we're coming out of the pandemic, and now we've got all this noise around politics, both local as well as international, that people coming to grips with life themselves is become like a very, you know, relevant thing. I was just curious if there's, do you have any thoughts on that?
People will always use literature as an escape. This is where I still find it a little bewildering that people read horror to escape from the evening news, because for me, I would rather read anything but something that horrifies me. Mm-hmm. Some people love it. They like to scare themselves silly as their entertainment, as their escape. A book should be something that you can crawl into and pull the cover closed so that you have somewhere to be that is not where you normally are. It's also one of the things that science fiction and fantasy is excellent at. I heard Lois McMaster Bujold, wonderful, fantastic writer of our field, give a talk to the American Library Association. She was quoting a study that had been done that there are type A readers and type B readers. Type A readers read the kind of stories that could take place in their daily lives, could actually happen, like a girl falling in love with a boy, or a girl becoming an assistant to a magazine editor and having her own career. Type B readers read anything but. And that means science fiction, fantasy, westerns, romances, you name it, but mostly genre fiction. Mm-hmm. And the librarians found that type B readers read 7 to 8 times as much as type A readers on the average, which means some of them are reading 20 books and some of them are reading possibly 2 while a type A reader is reading 1. So we're looking at real readers here because they're interested in science fiction and fantasy. They're interested in that sophisticated escape because we have to do really good world building. So they're looking for where our minds go. And it's just a wonderful place to be. The writers that we have that who are submitting stories to us have facile imaginations. They are very clever. They have great dialogue. They have great characters. They have great settings. And when they want to get away from what is happening in the world, like environmental disasters, politics, things like that, they find books to read. Now, mind you, some of them still go for things that are highly political, like the Wheel of Time books, or things that have a great deal of possibly repression in them, social repression, like The Handmaid's Tale. But they are reading it to help set their own minds in order and give them something that is not the here and the now. So I think that the contest is extremely important for that because we're bringing these new voices forward for readers to find, and we give them this fantastic showcase so that people can say, this is good, something that I can crawl into and that I can enjoy for a while. The short stories are fantastic for that. There's a lot of misunderstandings about short stories, such as they're the gateway to writing novels, which is true and not true. But it does teach you to write. It just doesn't teach you to write a novel.
It does put your name out there for somebody looking for you. You do have a name now out there that people can find.
It helps to say, I am a prize winner in this. Mm-hmm. And one of the most important things that being part of the contest is to have the writer be able to say to an editor, I have received editing and I did not die of it. And I did not try to kill the editor. It's incredibly important for editors to be able to say, this person is not going to fight me on every single semicolon. I can say to them, this doesn't work and here's why. Please fix this. So they have been professionally edited. And that's really important too. So writing a short story is a terrific way to learn how to write. And many of them expand and go on from there. I've talked to a number of the kids, I call them my kids, even though a couple of them are older than me. By the time they get to the contest, if they're, say, first or second quarter winners, they're no longer under the strictures of being amateurs. So some of them have already written books, sometimes more than one book, sometimes several books. They have published more stories than the one that is going to be in the anthology. So they're already seasoned professionals by the time they come to the gala. And that's terrific. I love to see them doing that. And they share information. The people who sat around at the last event found a place to sit on the floor and just chat with each other in between events. It was just charming and very heartening.
Yeah, it's they're good. They're good folk. That's all I say. The winners, it's a community that part of us, that they know that we've got their back. You know, we're constantly working. If someone writes to me and says, look, I've got a book coming out. Can you help? And I say, sure. Now that I got this podcast, I just got the phone with Nadia Corfor a little bit earlier. She's got this novel that's coming out in 2025. And so she's going to send it to me. I'm going to read it. And we're going to do an interview on that as part of the launch of it. But I get that every now and then, you know, someone, you know, they want to do that because it's got such a good reach on it. But we're always trying to be able, you know, we stay with you, we help each other, and it's a definitely good community that we've built. And you know, the example that you judges will set is really helps a lot too when they see that what you're there. you owe them nothing, but yet you're there to help them. And, you know, there are these little birdies in your hands and you throw them out there and say, fly, fly. And you want to help them exactly to, you know, to actually make that.
We do.
Know,
we do that. We welcome them into the company of professional writers. Mm-hmm. We welcome them. We'll give them advice. We'll help if they want. I've offered quotes to a few of them for their future works.
Yeah.
And they have something that is unique. And I find this with my writer's workshop at DragonCon as well, is they are now old army buddies. They're the cadre of 2023, 2022, et cetera. No one will ever know what it was like to be in their group except them. So mm-hmm. they are automatically a support group for one another. Now, there are people who will not participate necessarily. They won't be able to, or they're not clubby people. But when you're a writer, you're alone. You're there with the alphabet piano, and you are playing a tune that someone may never see. But when you get together with the people who are fellow winners, you are that cadre. And you have something to share that no one else will ever have to share except you. Mm-hmm. The 12 of you, or the 15 of you, whoever, however many people can make it that year, it's unique. And I think that it's a great thing for them.
Yeah.
Because now they have a company. It's an individual activity, but now they have people who know exactly what they've been through.
Which is absolutely true. And they stay together for years and years and years. They'll still maintain those relations. It's really amazing how that works. When Owen Hubbard created this contest, he had already written many, many essays from earlier on in the 30s and 40s that were now used in the workshops. Algis Budras is one that originally put them in there. And Tim had his favorite. Norson Scott Card has his favorite. And Anne had her favorite. Different judges had their favorite essays. And even though maybe what was happening in the 30s and 40s is no longer happening 90 years later, one thing I find is that a lot of the what he's talking about, the style, the technique, the business of writing, storytelling, how to build suspense is still very much as valid now as it was back then. Do you have any particular comments on that?
You're right about the ones that how he approaches a market is no longer valid, because you cannot simultaneously submit to magazines. There is no margin for being able to go back to another magazine and say, hey, this guy bought this story, which you were also buying, because by the time you get a contract from a magazine, they are already putting it into production, which means that they have to yank your story out, maybe even with the illustration that they commissioned for it. There's no time. So that kind of thing does not happen anymore. The way that he built his career, submitting to multiple magazines, doesn't work as well. There just aren't as many magazines as there were in the 30s and 40s. He had a lot more scope for short work. On the other hand, he probably never foresaw being able to self-publish, and that would have, his other essays can speak to that. To understand when you put your butt in your chair and your fingers on the keyboard is the most important thing you do, is to produce and to keep producing. And those essays are very important for that. He codifies them really well. They're very well written. I enjoy reading them. So it's good for the winners. It's good for any budding writer to read, to have these essays as a resource for them. It's nice to see what in perspective, in retrospective, to see what he was talking about, how things were for him as a writer coming up. But his most important statements are write, keep writing, research, learn about your world, research topics, talk to people. Don't just let the voices in your head be the only things that you hear. And I appreciate the way that he brings this forward. I find myself reading some of them and nodding and saying, oh yeah, yes, exactly. That is exactly the way that it works. Because some things in writing don't change.
That's a fact. So last question is, so what is your vision of the future of writers and illustrators of the future?
Well, I think that what it does extremely well, and we should keep on doing it, is to provide a forum for the young writers who are coming up, to provide them with feedback. I created, in my first months as coordinating judge, a letter called the Rejected with Comments, which goes back to many writers who would otherwise simply have been rejected in the past. These are for stories that they only need a little urging, a little nudge to be good enough, possibly for honorable mention or better. It contains a lot of things that people may not even be aware that they're doing, like writing a story in an overused trope or playing in somebody else's sandbox. We occasionally get Cthulhu stories and Frankenstein stories and stories based on fairy tales and so on. There are a lot of things that people are doing that don't give them the best possible appearance when they come to us. They're not saying anything new. They're just rehashing something that we've seen before, and so on. One of the things I'd like to put here that is actually in the rules is profanity. Please use alternate terms. I will be going along absolutely enjoying the heck out of a story, and then there's a whole spate of F words, and I have to say, I am not going to go on with this because the person didn't read the rules. Read the rules. It's there. So the contest gives excellent writers a chance to be someplace that is more permanent than a magazine, that gets attention worldwide, and now in audio. I think that's fantastic. For some of these kids, that is going to be the challenge. It's going to be the difference between being read by someone and not being read by someone. I have a couple of friends who do not read paper books anymore. They only listen to books. So the Writers of the Future has now stepped forward and is becoming something that is accessible to them. I presume when the time comes that we can just, you know, put the words straight into people's minds, that we'll be publishing it that way too. But in the meantime, we're going to have 12 excellent stories a year that we're going to be putting forward with illustrations and essays and work from some of the judges, and give the kids who come to the gala that encouragement, that pat on the back that means so much to a writer to say, yes, this is excellent. Yes, you're getting more than a check out of this. You're getting a boost. You're getting people whose names mean something to you saying that they really enjoyed what you did.
Which is amazingly true. And again, just the original purpose of this contest, as was created in 1983, it's like we're doing 40 years now. It's just, I came on board in volume two. So it's just, you know, a lot of water under the bridge, a lot of amazing stories and a lot of amazing talent. But as was originally stated when he launched it, a culture is as rich and capable of surviving as it has imaginative artists. It is with this in mind that I initiated a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for their creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. That is so proven to be like an amazing formula, an amazing purpose. And what's great about it is that there's so many, you know, incredible authors and artists as yourself, and Echo as the illustrator coordinating judge, that you find it so easy just to be able to step right in there and continue with that, because it's such a noble purpose to be able to have to carry forward. And especially even more so right now with divisive times, with people uncertain, you know, with what is the future going to hold? This gives you a chance to be able to step off the insane circle right now, you know, the spinning around the merry-go-round or whatever, and just sit down and just, all right, I just need to reorient myself. Let me just chill for a bit here. And you can just, I'm guaranteed you're going to have something you're going to love in this book that I've never found somebody not find something that they just like. I can promise anybody who reads Writers of the Future, you will find a story that you will absolutely love, and quite likely 12.
Every volume, you may find the story that is your favorite forever.
Yeah, absolutely.
So check them out.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Jody. I think it's been really good. It'll answer a lot of people's questions too, and keep them, you know, tracking with what we're trying to do with Writers of the Future, and why it's such an important thing, and why it's so important that we have you on board as the coordinating judge.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be part of it.
Yes, thank you. And thank you for listening. Subscribe to the Writers of the Future podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We've also been syndicated on the United Public Radio Network, where you can find these podcasts as well. Writers of the Future series can be purchased wherever books are sold in the U.S., Canada, the U.K., Australia, and South Africa, and available everywhere via Amazon.com. We are especially appreciative of our sponsor, Carnation, for supporting this podcast. Carnation was introduced in 1899, and 2024 marked its 125th birthday. So Carnation has been making delicious milk products for 1¼ centuries and is still going strong. If that doesn't show consumer support, I don't know what does. Writers and Illustrators of the Future are contests created by Elwyn Hubbard to provide a means for the aspiring writer and artist to be seen and acknowledged for 4 decades. It is free to enter and open to amateur short story writers and artists of science fiction or fantasy. Again, thank you very much, Jody.
Thank you. Thank you very much.